And welcome to the latest edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am President of SIMSEC and your host, Matthew Hipple. And today, we have our Director of Publications, Matthew Marighi, who is entering the Tufts 100K New Ventures Competition. So this is a school-wide competition for startups in three different categories: social impact, life sciences, and general high tech. With his team, Blue Water Metrics, Matt Marighi is pursuing the social impact aspect of this competition. Now, typically on this podcast, we discuss a number of topics ranging from international affairs to defense to procurement, but mostly things that somewhat fall within the things that are concerned with the military. But what we've done in the past here at SIMSEC, we've talked a lot about the sciences. We've talked about things like seasteading or things like the health of fisheries. And today that's what our discussion is going to be about. Because the Blue Water Metrics team is pursuing a method by which they increase the global capacity for the monitoring of the health of our seas. And I'll let Matt Marighi get into those specifically. So kick back, relax, and we'll be back with Matt Marighi after this short, shameless advertisement for SIMSEC from my wife.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we are back. So, as I said before, today we have Matthew Marighi. And Marighi, you know the drill here. You often host these podcasts. But in the sake of tradition, folks probably know who you are, but I'll turn the floor over to you to give me a 1 to 2 kind of minute introduction to who you are, where you're coming from, what your perspective is, so the audience kind of knows the guy that they're dealing with.
Well, thanks, Matt, and thanks, everyone, for getting me on here today. It is kind of weird being on the other side of this and having to introduce myself. I'm used to talking to interesting people as opposed to being talked to, so it's kind of nice to...
I'm an interesting guy. You're going to be talking to me. You're going to be talking to me, so it's fine.
Well, somewhat interesting. I've known you for too long. For the sake of the audience, my name is Matt Marighi. I am a second-year master's student at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which is an international relations school at Tufts University. It's up in Medford, Massachusetts, so maybe about like a 15-minute drive northwest of downtown Boston. I've just about to finish up my 2-year program here, studying mostly maritime studies, international security, and Pacific Asia. And as part of my my work here, including for my capstone, which is kind of our replacement for a thesis, I am working on a startup venture called Blue Water Metrics, as Mr. Hipple just outlined. So Blue Water Metrics is going to be a new way to gather data on ocean health, which is going to be by using crowdsourcing, which I'll talk a little bit more about. Before I went to Tufts, I was a GS, government civilian working for the Air Force doing international affairs. So a lot of foreign military sales, did a lot of senior leader travel to international air shows. So my background is mostly in a security capacity, but now I'm branching out a little bit more into the science and the business side of the oceans.
So a little bit of a model here for our topic on the podcast today. And it's nice to know that you've left the prison of the Air Force to come over to the brighter side of maritime and naval affairs. So we welcome you with open arms.
I appreciate being here.
All right. So you're talking about crowdsourcing the monitoring of the seas. So before we get into some of the more grand kind of strategic scope of what Blue Water Metrics is trying to do, what do you mean specifically? Crowdsourcing monitoring of the seas. What does that look like in practice?
So in practice, what it's going to look like is essentially outfitting the vessels that are out on the water doing other jobs with sensors that will be able to gather the kinds of data that people need in order to analyze ocean health. So we're talking, you know, the giant cargo ships that are the backbone of the global economy, the ferries, everything from, you know, the Staten Island ferry to the small ones in New Bedford, Massachusetts that carry people around over regular areas over a long period of time, fishing vessels, which go really far out to, you know, do their other jobs. So the plan is essentially to take their sunk costs that these vessels are already, you know, going through for their businesses and essentially piggyback off of that to provide data on ocean health. Because one of the problems that you see right now in terms of how ocean health data is gathered is it's either really expensive or not complete. So the big methods, you got satellites, which don't actually penetrate very far down in the water column, which is kind of a problem. They're also very expensive, getting older. You've got research vessels like the Neil Armstrong out of Woods Hole. It's operated by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, for people that haven't worked at them. Great organization. The problem is that government budgets being what they are and the expense that goes into dedicated ships, we're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in acquisition, hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to operate. It's very expensive, especially now. And that also means they can't be in many places at once. And then you've got buoys, which are fine, except they don't really move a whole lot. Most of them don't even move at all. So they're kind of a pain to maintain. You have to recalibrate the sensors, which means you have to go find them. They're navigation hazards. You know, there's a lot of issues with the ways that we currently gather. So what we want to do is essentially leverage the fact that sensors are getting a lot cheaper with this Internet of Things revolution you've probably heard of, and then slap them onto ships that are doing other jobs anyway, get more data, get it cheaper, and get it in places that we haven't been able to get data before.
So what kind of systems are you guys thinking about on, before we get into the how of getting these systems on the ships, what kind of systems are you guys thinking about? What kind of data are you looking to collect?
So the big three that we're starting with right now is subsurface temperature, salinity, and acidity. Those are kind of the big three because they factor into some of the largest challenges as well as some of the largest industries that are willing to pay for the data. So subsurface temperature is really important for climate change research. It's good for analyzing fish stocks and fishing quotas. It's really useful for weather forecasting as well, since the oceans are a big part of the weather systems. So that's temperature is the kind of the big one to start off with for our kind of minimum product. The next thing from there, you know, salinity, obviously the ocean's getting a lot more salty as time goes on, which is causing a lot of changes, everything from fish migrations to, you know, coral reef die off. Same with acidity, you know, that's becoming a really big problem for shellfish, which is not just kind of an idle concern, but important for, you know, for shellfish fisheries, for shellfish farming and aquaculture, tourism issues with, you know, coral reef die-offs. So it's a lot of big environmental challenges, but also a lot of big industries that are sort of associated with those environmental challenges.
So you've touched a little bit on the how. You've mentioned industries willing to pay for the data. And just correct me if I'm wrong, what I'm hearing is that we're talking about the scientific community, folks with grants willing to give you money for this data, as well as the fishing industry. Are we talking about anybody else in particular, or would you say those are the big two?
Those are two of the big ones. The other one actually are weather forecasters. And this is something that I learned through the result of, you know, doing all of this work, is that weather is an industry in the United States. It's a $3 billion industry and it's growing every year. If you include budgets on like public sector weather stuff, it's more like six. So we're talking a huge industry and one that relies on up-to-date, fast data in order to make accurate predictions. And obviously, you know, okay, the money, okay, there's some money in it. That's you know, nice. But it's also, you know, we're talking, you know, predicting superstorms and figuring out how people's lives are going to get affected in coastal communities. So what we're trying to do with this thing is go after large markets that can be used to sustain our day-to-day operations, but really going after things that have real positive externalities and are going to, you know, help people out.
All right, so we have some of the how. We're talking about these industries that are willing to pay for your side of the operations. But on the other side, you have the ships where this equipment will be installed. Let's talk a little bit about some of that how. How do you incentivize these companies, these individual ships, to take on your equipment? How do you pick which routes, which kinds of ships that you want to use? And how will the installations occur? Is this something where you're going to just offer these companies a modicum of profit and say, but we'll pay the installation costs? What's the actual, how does this end up happening?
That's one of the reasons why this hasn't really been done before, is because, well, the technology's only come around really in the past like 4 or 5 years in terms of making the sensors cheap enough to actually make this, you know, economically interesting. But also the biggest challenge is exactly the one you've identified, which is getting vessel operators of very different types and very different, you know, qualities in order to sign up on this. I mean, you know, the difference between, say, like a Maersk Shipping Line, which is a giant international corporation, versus, say, you know, a blue collar fisherman who's operating a single vessel out of New Bedford. They both have potential value to offer in terms of providing this large sensor network. But in terms of what their interests are, what their incentives are, and frankly, whether they care about it or not, is very, very different. So the way that we're marketing it is through a couple of different ways. So the big thing is that all of these vessels will be providing value for their daily operations by participating. So everybody wins with better weather forecasting, because you can figure out where, you know, cheap places to navigate are. You can avoid, for the sake of like shipping companies, delays when they're in port and unloading their facilities. They can calculate faster currents, so they can figure out effective and efficient ways to do the shipping routes. So there's some economic benefits indirectly by providing the data that will improve the services that they themselves consume.
And are these things that they would in turn have access to? So you said that weather is a large industry. So is this, hey, you install these systems on your ship and you'll have access to our data? Or is it something more nuanced, like, hey, if you do this, you are helping the weather industry in general improve the data?
So it's a little bit more of the latter, at least for now, and at least for initially. So we want to start off just for the sake of, you know, kind of being on a shoestring budget and making sure the system works, to just focus on the data harvesting. So it would be a little bit more indirect. We want to explore more analytics and kind of expansive sorts of offerings for these guys in the future. But for right now, since a lot of them are already consuming commercial services that do the same thing, it'll essentially just be an indirect way for them to improve the value of the service that they're already buying. The other part, though, is, and one of the reasons why we want to be a nonprofit, is because we want to have different ways that people can contribute. So for the sake of a giant fishing company, you know, if we offered them revenue sharing, it's probably not going to be interesting or economically viable enough for them to want to go through with it. But if they could possibly donate the data as a tax write-off, or host the sensor as a tax write-off, in addition to also being, you know, showing the global community that they are being responsible environmental actors. Exactly. Whereas, say, you know, a private fisherman down in, you know, a small coastal community, I mean, he probably might feel some benefit, but most of these guys are more blue collar. A little bit of money would actually go a long way, especially with the fishing industry being as hard hammered as it is right now. So that's kind of what we wanted to do by being this nonprofit, is to provide people that could actually use the money the opportunity to get money. And then for companies that the money is not really as useful, but the reputation, the tax write-offs, and the giving back element's useful, to give them something that'll be valuable to them. So that's kind of the way that we see it. So the incentives are a little bit of indirect service improvements, but a lot of it is also sort of the economic incentives that we want to offer.
So we understand your intentions for implementation, your goals, how you're going to engage with these different kinds of entities. Well, let's talk about some of the challenges. Now, you've spoken about some of the funding challenges, and you've addressed those and the different ways that you're going to incentivize companies. But those who have operated on ships know that they're not just a black box. This isn't as simple as slapping a sensor on the side of a hull and sending a ship on its way. Ships end up getting growth on their hulls. they go out to sea and they'll do discharge, so there'll be hot water on one side of the ship, cold water on the other, depending on where they are. The engineering plant within the ship itself may raise the temperature of parts of the ships or cause vibrations. You may even have something in the nature of the hull itself change the salinity of the water around it. There's a lot of factors that can change the data that's being gathered from ships. The data that you're going to be collecting is going to run into some of these challenges. Have you looked into these technical challenges, and how does the Blue Metrics Group, how do they plan to overcome these technical issues?
Well, it's a very fair question. That's one that we are actually still in the midst of dealing with. So as a result of winning the recent competition, we have now a little bit of seed capital.
Oh, you won it?
Yeah, well, we got the second place in the social impact track. So.
Why didn't you say? I thought this contest hadn't happened yet.
Oh, no, it was just this past Thursday.
Well, that's why. Okay, we talked about this before the contest happened.
Yeah, sorry. I should
way
have,
to bury the lead. You're a contest man. Winner. Now we're talking about this is a podcast about the winner of the contest. But anyways, okay, our loyal listeners will get to this point and find out you won, so whatever.
Yeah,
we're not going to edit it and put it in the front.
What you could probably do is you could probably put it up front if you just record it separate.
Nah.
All right, where do you want me to start back from?
No, this was see, now you ruined it. We were just having a conversation. This was going to go in. In fact, I won't even edit this part out. This is everyone's going to see behind the veil and see how this works. Anyways,
the dirty world of podcast editing.
The dirty world of podcasts, exactly. All the F bombs I said like the F bomb 18 times, but you don't even know. I didn't really, but that's real time strategy. That's where all the F bombs happen. Anyways, so you were talking about the technical challenges of sort of variations that come from operating monitoring equipment on the ship.
Right. So now that we have that seed money from the from the second place win, we're going to use that to go through and develop the sensors. Now, we actually have had a lot of conversations pretty much since October of last year with a group called the Internet of Things Impact Lab in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I also realize now I've used New Bedford a couple of times and most people don't know where that is. In fact, I didn't even initially before I got involved with this. But it's actually, strangely and interestingly enough, it's the largest fishing port in the United States by catch value because of all the scallops that come from the Northeast. So we're talking hundreds of fishing vessels, including some of the largest scallopers on the East Coast, are operating out of there. It's about an hour, 15 minutes south of Boston. And so, but interestingly enough, there's this guy named Chris Resendiz who started this Internet of Things Impact Lab, which is part seed fund, investment fund for new technologies, part kind of networking group for big companies to find small IoT initiatives. And their big goal is to basically instrument the physical world. So we're talking instruments on not just, vessels, obviously the maritime nature is a big part of it, but also they're talking about instrumenting wells to gather data on well waters and the amount of water that's underground and aquifers, because a lot of what we've found with a lot of things right now is we kind of use some scientific extrapolations to figure out what's going on. And it's much better to get ground truth. So the IoT Labs has relationships with some of the biggest names in the business for sensors. So we're talking Dell, Caterpillar, Boat Tracks, a couple of the really big, operators. So they've already started, coming up with ideas for what the sensors will look like. And now that we've got some more money, we're going to pour that into, investment in, figuring it out. We're looking at a couple of different methods, especially because the intake issue is a really big one. The benefit being that you don't have to have something outside the ship, which means you don't have to worry about magnetism and all the other problems you outlined. So we are still looking at either ways to improve the intake system is one. We are looking at some that'll be put on the outside of the vessel, but we still have to do some engineering in that regard. We're looking also at really small ones that could possibly be dragged at certain points in time. That way, small enough that it wouldn't actually affect the hydrodynamics, but large enough that it could actually do the job. So there's also a couple of others that involve expendable charges that are fired from a rig that's put on the railings on the side of the ship. So there's a bunch of different systems we're looking at to try to innovate on in order to make it more useful. But the big element, in addition to the vessel mechanics, is also the internet element, this Internet of Things IoT element. Because one of the reasons why the volunteer programs that NOAA and the National Weather Service run, not a lot of vessels participate, is because they're kind of manpower intensive. It's like every 6 hours, you got to take a bucket thermometer, throw it off the side, measure the stuff, or pay the money in order to host the sensor on your vessel and have a scientist come and recalibrate it and whatnot. We want to try to minimize the manpower that goes into it. So there are sensors right now that can essentially be in a passive collect mode while it's out on the deep ocean. And then as soon as they hit either Wi-Fi at a port or even a cellular network, it'll kind of wake up and automatically upload the data to a cloud database. So there's a lot of really big engineering challenges inside of it, which is great because I am a political science guy and I am totally qualified to work all of these things. But there's a ton of smart people that we're partnering with down in New Bedford right now that have been doing this for years. So we're still, the short version is we're still working on it, but we're looking at a lot of different methods.
You've sort of skipped ahead to one of the questions that I was going to ask you, because the way to upload all this data was going to be one of the critical kind of questions. Is now what I was going to ask you, and it's clearly is now dead, but still an interesting thing to think about, is that, you know, you have all these systems, you have them persistent on all these different ships. You could almost make the argument that a way to get this kind of data and a way to incentivize people to do this is get this data live. And as part of this deal to get me live update, somebody else has access to all the data around the ship. But it sounds like you've come to a more practical and a cheaper answer, which is that when ships pull in, they take all this data that I'm assuming is geotagged. Like all this data will be tagged by location.
Yeah, that's the intent, because especially for climate change researchers, and weather forecasters, you know, that GPS tied element's very, very important for, figuring out where these changes are happening. But there's a dark side to that too, or a counter side, which is, you know, just like I mentioned, all the vessel operators that are going to host the sensors have different interests. There is no way we can have live GPS feeds on this data coming from fishermen, because their main concern is that they basically keep their fishing areas kind of like proprietary and protected. You know, that's just part of the industry, is, you know, a good magician never revealing his tricks and whatnot. So for us, we want to have different types of upload rates, so that ships that are already transmitting AIS, where you already know where they are and everybody knows where they are, you know, that where it doesn't matter, to have them automatically upload and have it go faster. And then for fishermen to essentially have it be less frequent and also have the information scrubbed, so you don't know if in a certain area it's a fishing ship or a ferry.
I see. So like anonymized.
Exactly. So we're still working on the mechanics for what to do with that. But it's interesting. I had never figured that would be a big challenge, but that's what you run into when you're doing these interesting integration works, or when you have different stakeholders that have very different interests. You have to find a way to create a system that can benefit, or at the very least not piss off, you know,
all of your customers.
Exactly.
Well, it's intriguing because they're half your customers and they're half the folks producing the product. So it's kind of, it is kind of a weird relationship.
Yeah, it is. And that's, again, why people really haven't done this before, is it is a weird sort of entity to deal with. And that's why we want to also, be a nonprofit. That way we can be more of a partner as opposed to exclusively just a business contact. We want to make the data valuable and, you know, give economic incentives for people to host it. But we also, you know, we don't want to have it just be a, you know, bottom line kind of relationship. We'd rather just be partners with these people to, you know, do some good.
How did you get involved in this program?
So this idea has been kicking around between a couple of our co-founders for the better part of a year. So it started kind of as a back of the napkin sort of conversation, and some initial work that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, HUI, for anyone that's worked with them, it's one of the world's best oceanographic research groups. It's a government institution out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It's a kind of a subdivision of NOAA in a way, or like has that relationship with NOAA. So great researchers. They go down to New Bedford a lot, and one of our senior advisors, who's the port director down there, Ed Anthus Washburn, had conversations with them about some of the work they did with fishermen, and they saw it as a opportunity for fishermen to possibly have alternate sources of revenue because they could gather data cheaper than NOAA can because of the high expense of the ships. So It started as a back of the napkin conversation with some research being done on it last summer, but it really started to pick up steam in October of last year, which is kind of when myself and a couple of our other team members got brought on board. So the way that this evolved, and I know people that listen to this podcast are probably tired of me talking about how great Fletcher School is, but the Fletcher School really is great because it had one of the co-founders is both the head of the Maritime Studies program as well as the entrepreneur coach at Fletcher. And so he's been the one kind of marshaling this, and the education I've been able to do at Fletcher was flexible enough where I could work on this as part of my schooling. And I was able to get pulled in through that. You know, I've always been interested in entrepreneurship ever since I was young. And I kind of saw the opportunity to, you know, give something a shot that was interesting and viable and compelling. And so it essentially just was a happy accident that I happened to walk into Rocky Weitz, who's the professor. I walked into his office to talk about entrepreneurship, and he said, "Hey, I want you to come and work for this thing."
That's really, you know, that is just a really kind of nice confluence of factors. You know, they say that luck is just hard work paying off, and I imagine this is the case for you. Is if you work hard enough, you get involved in the right things. Is that opportunities all around us? The question is, are you a compelling enough of a person? Are you qualified enough that someone makes these opportunities available for you? In many cases. So as you've gone through this process, what would you say is one of the most surprising things that you've learned? And let's break this into a twofer. On one side, on the planning and execution process of entrepreneurship in general. So you're part of a new organization, you're trying to reach out to people. And on the second side, sort of the technical and execution aspect. So you've already mentioned one. You've mentioned the sort of the proprietary nature of the navigation of a lot of the fishing fleet and how they protect their data very jealously. What are some of those other technical and kind of execution aspects that you've learned that have been very interesting and or surprising to you?
So I guess I'll start with the technical one first, and then I'll go into the general entrepreneurship side. So the technical side was kind of what we talked about a little bit in terms of the for a guy that's not a mariner and not a seafaring man, at least from his career, the challenges in terms of, you know, the biological buildup, the electrical charges, the water discharges, ballast water, all of those challenges that you have to deal with in terms of, because when I initially thought about this, you know, I know the other members of my team were smarter than I was, so they didn't have this in mind. I was like, oh yeah, you can just slap something on the side of the boat. That'll be easy. And then it's like, no. Apparently.
Well, one of the things, I hate to interrupt, but one of the things that I've been thinking of with an example of how precise kind of these issues are that Marigi's talking about, for those who haven't operated on a vessel at sea, imagine a ship's draft, and that's how deep the ship goes into the water, is even with something as simple as temperature. You go to a pool, you go to an outdoor pool, you go 6 feet deep in the water, and all of a sudden that temperature changes severely. It happens just like that out in the ocean, and on vessels at sea conducting commercial work. If it's a fishing vessel taking on a large load of fish, if it's a commercial vessel offloading several tons of cargo, just the fuel load on a ship matters. You can have something that's 40 feet deep in the ocean, and then you pull into port, you offload, and you don't take anything on, and all of a sudden it's 20 feet deep. And that makes a big difference for temperatures. And so that's the kind of issue that you can get into when trying to get this type of precise data off of ships. And I'm sure some of the challenges that they've had in the past collecting this kind of data, and that makes a lot of difference.
It really does, especially when one of the values of our system is that it's going to be able to get that subsurface temperature and salinity, which satellites can't penetrate far enough down to get. So that's one of the big challenges that I wasn't aware of before I started working on this team, was just how much sort of basically the vessel physics play in. Like, this is not even an engineering challenge, there is an engineering element, but it's really about the physics of where the sensor is, how it transmits. That kind of stuff actually becomes really big. The other part, the other technical challenge was also on the data side, which there's a little bit of the issue, you know, with the GPS that we talked about, but there's also the issue in terms of how often it uploads, how often do different consumers need that upload? How much these sensors need to calculate? Because researchers need sometimes 2 to 3 decimal places of precision in terms of their measurements, whereas other industries don't necessarily need that, which means there's different costs that come along with it. There are so many different facets of this that kind of glom on together that it makes it a very interesting challenge. And that feeds into the big entrepreneurship challenge on like the business side, which is – and if for anybody that's listened to the Startup Podcast, which I highly recommend for anybody that's even remotely interested in dealing with this, there's a lot of stuff you just don't know when you first have the idea. And the companies that survive the fact that there's stuff that they don't know, if you want to, since it's a security podcast, the unknown unknowns, even the known unknowns are bad enough, but there are a lot of unknown unknowns that are going to crop up. And the people that essentially survive the process are the ones who can basically think on the fly, figure out ways to either make their initial idea work or realize that their initial idea, there's no way it's going to work, but a, you know, variation, a 2.0 version of their idea might actually be useful. An example of this is Blue Water Metrics started off as a for-profit company in terms of our idea. And we were working on that idea for months. But the more that we broke down the industry and the more that we figured out what the financial incentives could be and then how valuable the data would be versus how much interest there would be from venture capitalists for private companies, and we couldn't square the circle. It just couldn't be done. But then we looked at the nonprofit angle and we're like, oh, actually, this might work out a lot better because, you know, throughout the core of this or throughout the entirety of this, we wanted this to be originally a business that had a social impact nonprofit sort of ethos inside of it. So now it's the opposite. Now it's a nonprofit, which is going to have a business orientation so it can sustain its operations. It's a small nuance, but essentially it's what do you prioritize, but then also what are the financial mechanisms that will then underpin the initiative that it is you're trying to do. So those have been the biggest surprises. I'm learning new things every day. It's definitely a learning experience. And I'm really happy I got involved with it. It's been a real pleasure so far.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned this. The only reason we're doing this podcast is because you posted this on Facebook, and I was like, oh, I mean, I thought you were my friend, and I thought you would have mentioned all of these great things to me, but clearly, we're not as close friends as I thought. So,
all right, there's two pillars of that. First of all, you're awful. So,
well,
second
of
all, you're the one that has like a 4-month-old baby now.
That's true.
Like, you've been busy. You've been doing important things, which is good. It means we just need to hang out more. Yeah, while we're on the subject of people finding stuff out about on Facebook, the pictures that you put up of your child and the videos from dancing
on a
restaurant
table,
it's horrible.
He's as cute as a baby.
Now, no one's going to see this because, you know, it's a podcast, but Mriggy is now looking at, it's a baby passport.
Oh, my God, I didn't realize they had baby
passports. Babies get passports. Isn't this the most adorable thing you've seen in your life?
How does your baby have a better passport picture than I do?
Well, it's not hard if you're a baby. You're really super adorable. But wow, we got this in the mail, and this is the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life because it's such an official government document for travel. It has a little baby face inside of it. All right, well, that's enough.
You know at some point you're going to accidentally pull out that passport when you're trying to go through customs.
I'm going to pick this up. All right, so to finish up here, you've already mentioned the Startup Podcast, but do you have anything else that you think our listeners should reach out for, maybe off the bookshelf? Some good podcasts you've been listening to. Of course, Blue Water Metrics, recommend everyone take a look at that. And I'm sure Matt Mriggy will be having more come out on this on SimSec and in other places. But what else do you have going on? Not even necessarily you going on, but things that you're reading, things that you're interested in that you think our listeners should be on the lookout for.
Well, I guess I'll take this opportunity to plug an article that I will, inshallah, soon be co-authoring with Katie Burkhart, who is a recovering SWO, just finishing up at the Harvard Kennedy School. Good friend of mine. We're going to co-author an article about blue tech, which is essentially the industry buzzword for maritime innovation, which is a whole host of like different kinds of industries. I mean, everything from like the sensor work that we're working on to maritime insurance. insurance stuff and a lot of interesting things coming out of Iceland involving the utilization of byproducts from fish and shellfish catch. So a lot of really interesting things that we're going to write about and trying to put it from the direction of what are the things the U.S. Navy can essentially piggyback off of as part of this newfound private sector interest in blue tech. So that's as far as the writing side. That'll hopefully be coming up in the next month or so. Before Katie goes to work for Senator Thune in D.C.
Cool.
As far as podcasts go, Startup obviously is great. Any of the podcasts in the Gimlet sphere, which is a company that – yeah, so the Startup podcast follows the establishment of Gimlet, which is a podcast company. So it's very, very meta. But there's a lot of other great ones like Reply All for internet technology, Sampler for kind of experimenting with other kinds of podcasts. Surprisingly Awesome is really good. And then as far as things to read for anybody that's out there that, you know, in the maritime space that's mostly done security work but is interested in other aspects of sort of the maritime experience, definitely pick up a copy of the book The Box, which is about the history of the cargo container, like the standard cargo container, is a surprisingly interesting story of how a North Carolinian trucker basically started off with a single truck, created a trucking empire, and then developed this box, which is now the ubiquitous
the Connex
sort of
box.
Symbol of globalization.
Yeah.
It's really awesome. It's a great, compelling story. And it's, you know, as a security guy, I never figured I'd be getting interested in this kind of stuff, but it's really fascinating.
Matt, I really appreciate you for coming on with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, and looking forward to hearing from you more.